The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good morning, everyone. Good morning. And especially if you're new, welcome to IMC. The topic for today comes out of the talks, reflections from this retreat, 7-day retreat. And I would like to start by making two statements that are meant to be provocative and on opposite ends of some kind of spectrum. And they have to do with the Dharma. And that's kind of the topic of today, the Dharma. What's the Dharma? And so the first statement has to do with the Dharma, meaning teachings of the Buddha. And if you were going to condense the teachings of the Buddha down to a very simple statement, the simplest statement, so simple and ordinary that you couldn't believe it was Buddhism, this would be the statement. If you stop doing something that's harming, the harming stops. If you stop doing something that's harming yourself, the harm stops. In a nutshell, that's Buddhism. All the rest of Buddhism arises out of that statement or that understanding, that insight. So that's one provocative statement. The other provocative statement has to do with wider meanings of Dharma. Dharma also means truth, the way things are. Sometimes say the natural law, the way things are. And a little bit hard to encapsulate what the Dharma is in this, in terms of the truth or the way things are, nature. Some people call it make an equivalent to nature. But the provocative thing to say is that for many Buddhists in the history of Buddhism, the concept or the idea or the reality of Dharma has a comparable place in their hearts, in their lives, as God would have in the lives of theists. And people relate to the Dharma in many the same way. They look to the Dharma for support, for refuge, for protection, for inspiration, for deep sense of meaning in life. And they look for the Dharma for truth. They look to Dharma for liberation and freedom. And not Dharma that is, just the teachings of the Buddha, but something that's much deeper than that. And it's not the same as God, but it has a value in people's lives that's comparable to God. Though there are some people who will equate the two, God and Dharma are the same, but then you have to ask them what their definition of God is, because there's so many. And like the Thai teacher Buddhadasa, a famous Thai teacher from the last century, interfaith dialogues, he would say, oh, we're talking about the same thing, Dharma and God. But it was not a personal creator God that was being referred to. So those are the two provocative statements. One is so ordinary that, it's nothing special, right? If you have a splinter in your foot and you're walking around, then you reach down and pull the splinter out. And so you stop hurting. That's a pretty ordinary thing to do. The other, to equate Dharma with God or somehow put him in the same category as God, that's another extreme statement that some people say, wait a minute, why did I come to IMC for today? This is a little bit, I didn't sign up for this theist thing, and now God's, Gil's talking about God. But, I don't do that too often, do I? And so probably I get away for it for one day. So the first statement is really a reworking or restating of the Four Noble Truths. The Four Noble Truths are the kind of often seen as being the core insight and realization the Buddha had the night of his awakening, and what catalyzed his freedom, and what expressed it, and how he taught it, and said that all the teachings of the Buddha arise out of the Four Noble Truths. And the Four Noble Truths, you know, when you put the word, you know, Buddhism is one of the great world religions, it has a central teaching called the Four Noble Truths, it sounds like we're getting to something really heavy, and something really religious. Do I have to believe? And I'm not sure I'm going to believe this religious stuff, you know. And so then they have these proclamations, sounds kind of heavy, you know. The truth, the noble truth of suffering, that's kind of heavy. The noble truth of the cause of suffering. The noble truth of the end of suffering. And then the noble path leading to the end of suffering. So this begins, sounds a little bit heavy compared to saying, if you stop doing something that's hurtful, the hurt stops. And the first is something very ordinary that we all kind of aware of in a daily life. But the Four Noble Truths are really saying that. There's something very ordinary. And I think it's helpful when you look at Buddhism, to hear Buddhist teachings, to start with the assumption that you already understand what's being talked about. You already do it. As opposed to that Buddhism is teaching something foreign to you, that's outside of your experience, you might listen to what's being said, and from the point of view, how do I already know this? Do I already do this? So, for example, in the Four Noble Truths, it's really ordinary experience that many of us, a thousand times of a day, are kind of operating from the perspective as if the Four Noble Truths are really a useful point of view. So, for example, if you go shopping, you know, at the supermarket, and you choose the wrong line to exit, you know, to pay for your food. It's, you know, it's the one that's going really, really slow. And so you feel your impatience, your frustration arising, and so you have various choices of what to do with your frustration. But one choice you have is to look at it, is not to blame other people and check out clerk being too slow or people in front of you buying too much food, but rather is to look at yourself and say, you know, I'm really holding on here to this idea that I'm supposed to get on to important things in my life. I'm in a hurry. And actually, I'm not in a hurry at all, but I just kind of, you know, have a habit of being impatient. And my impatience has reared itself, and I'm holding on to that. And, you know, this is not comfortable. So what if I just kind of close my eyes standing in line here and breathe and let go of my impatience? And the impatience goes away, and then you find that the frustration, the anxiety, or the pressure you feel goes away as well. That's a pretty ordinary thing to do. I think it doesn't take, you know, PhD in Buddhist studies to understand the value of letting go. Or you're walking out the door of the supermarket, and you're set. It's important. You finally got out the checkout line, and it's important to get to your car and get to where you're going next. And so you feel this. You know, you start picking up the speed, and you're heading towards the door, and some person with 32 kids, maybe a whole school class or something, wants to go in through the door at the same time that you want to go in through. And so what do? You know, you suddenly feel like it's pressure. You know, like I better hurry up and speed up before those kids, you know, do or, you know. But you, in the context, it doesn't make sense to barrel through the kids. And it doesn't, so you let go of your desire to get through the door first and you stand there and wait for the kids to get by. Or to make maybe even a more kind of simple, ordinary experience, how many of you have been driving your car and see in the distance that the traffic light is green for you, but you wonder, can you make it? And so you start kind of feeling a certain kind of tension, maybe in your stomach, maybe in your shoulders, your hands, maybe in your gas pedal foot. And then you kind of pushing the accelerator a little bit, and then the light turns yellow or in green, red. And at some point you say, you know, it's not worth it. It's not worth the anxiety, the pushing, the stress. I think I'll let go. And then as you let go, that tension, anxiety you had falls away. So this, I think what I'm trying to say is these are really ordinary things that people do all the time, where they recognize that somehow that they're some way that they're operating is causing stress, causing discomfort, causing suffering. It's not worth it, or it's okay to let go of it. And they let people let go of it. I suspect you let go 1,000 times a day. To make the analysis a little bit more closer to the whole Four Noble Truths is say that this is the example I gave at the retreat. Say that you have this beautiful meal being served and they have dessert, which is unusual in the retreats. So, you know, it's chocolate. And so you mindfully take a piece of chocolate together with the rest of your meal. And you go have your meal mindfully and everything's wonderful and nice. And you have your chocolate at the end. It's very nice. And this is really nice. I think I'd like seconds on the chocolate. That would be really good for me. You know, I've had a tough day here. You know, I probably deserve it. And in any ways, it's very pleasant, and I really would like that pleasure. So you go into the kitchen, and you walk through the door, and you see there's one more piece of chocolate left. And you see someone else coming through the other door. And they're a little bit closer, because, you know, they're not going to go for that chocolate. And so, and you're concerned, you feel yourself tightening up, and you see the chocolate, the person comes over and he takes the last chocolate, and there's no chocolate for you. So then, the frustration of the frustrated desire leads to anger and resentment. So you feel the resentment. You're aware of it. So you have a number of choices. One choice is to fuel and get involved in that resentment and blame the person, blame the cooks. Since it's an IMC retreat, you could write a letter to the IMC president that somehow the chocolate budget is not enough and this is really an injustice and something has to be done. Start a hunger strike outside of IMC and feel, really get fueled and excited by this, and really get involved and live in this world of resentment and being a victim and how could they do this to me and take that route. Another route to take is to realize, wait a minute, everyone's, I'm here alone, I'm on a retreat, I'm practicing here, that person didn't see me, it's pretty special to have chocolate, I got my first piece anyway, and I'm going back to meditate in a few minutes anyway. I think that what I need to do is somehow take responsibility for this resentment. If I want to meditate and not spend the whole next sitting writing letters to IMC, I think I need to kind of turn around and look at my contribution to my suffering here. And then, once you realize that, you say, I think what's best here is to be careful with my energy. I was about to go stomping out the door and slamming this door shut, and give the cook a piece of my mind. And, I don't think that that's a useful thing to do. I think that that's kind of not very compassionate. It's maybe kind of harsh and cruel, even unkind. I think I better be careful with my attitude, my energy here, especially on a silent retreat. Everybody's quiet and peaceful. I think I'd be careful here with my energy. I don't want to cause any further harm in the world. So I'll be careful with it. So I'll be careful with my speech. I'll be careful with my actions. And then I have this, this burning resentment about the lost chocolate piece going on. It's just like powerful resentment. It's not useful for me to keep churning away with this kind of thinking. I got to do something about it. And if I think I'll go for a long walk. Going for a walk settles me down. Get into my body, get the energy going in my body, kind of flowing. And I'll go for a long walk and kind of change how I'm feeling. let it go, let it dissipate. And also, if I just keep paying attention to the present moment, come back and be mindful of here and now, of what's going on here right now, the energy I have, the feelings I have, and not get caught up with what happened in the kitchen 5 minutes ago. If I really stay present and mindful, that'll help this process of healing what I'm feeling. And in addition to that, if I calm down, let me focus my breathing and get concentrated and calm, that also helped dissipate it and settle me down. And so you go for a 10-minute walk, you do this, and then you come back. That is a description of the Eightfold Path, the fourth of the Noble Truths. It's an ordinary thing. People can imagine. Hopefully you can imagine yourself doing that sometimes. You don't need Buddhism to tell you to do those things. But the first step of the Eightfold Path involves taking responsibility for your contributions to your suffering. Not get caught up in blaming other people, which sometimes is appropriate enough, but that's not where your freedom is going to occur. So you're willing to look here. The second step of the Eightfold Path is being careful with your attitude that you have, so that if you have some unhealthy attitude, it doesn't spill over and cause harm. The third is right speech. Careful what you say to the cook. After all, she's going to cook the next meal. Your actions. Careful you don't, again, cause actions which cause harm. Right livelihood doesn't quite fit in this example, perhaps. And then the sixth of the Eightfold Steps is called right effort. It's a very simple thing. It's the effort to shed unhealthy states of mind and cultivate healthy states of mind. So being burning and resentment is not healthy. Let me see what I can do to shed that. I'll cultivate a healthy state of mind by going for this walk. And then staying in the present moment and being mindful is the seventh step, right mindfulness, and calming down and being concentrated is the eighth step. So what I'm trying to do here is to pass on the idea that the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, this core teachings of the Buddhism, are not so esoteric and strange, not something we have to import from Buddhism into our lives, but is something we're already doing in small ways. We never thought about it in those terms, but in fact you could, and you see, oh yeah, I already do that in different situations. And if you can see that you're already doing it, then can you expand what you're doing into more areas of your life? Can you be more thorough with it? And that's what Buddhism is pointing to, is a possibility of taking this very ordinary insight, this very ordinary way in which people live their lives, and doing it phenomenally thoroughly, completely, deeply, penetrating and pervasively in one's life, to transform one's life in a very deep way. But it's not doing something strange, or even religious, some people would say. It's taking an ordinary thing. So it's quite remarkable on retreats, like this retreat I'm doing now, to see how this operates in that kind of context, where people can start getting still enough, mindful enough, to see the underlying, and not be distracted from themselves. We're often running around being distracted. And to really see what's really happening, heightened sensitivity, a heightened sensitivity to the body, to the mind, to the heart, and what's happening. And it's a surprise for some individuals, especially if you're new, to discover how deep the harming is that's going on in the mind. So, for example, one person on the retreat was surprised how pervasive her fear is. There's fear all the time. I didn't realize I was always afraid. And fear is, the activity of fear hurts. And to do the Eightfold Path is to look and really understand the roots of the fear, to see what is it that I'm contributing here that helps make that fear. And if you understand how pervasive and deep is the underlying kind of foundation of how we think and respond and intend in the world, then if you can uproot that fear, it changes the whole foundation of our life. We can put a stronger, better foundation in it. Another person was surprised by how much critical judgments is constantly there. Always judging, always critical about something, self, others. And it's kind of this pervasive kind of attitude that was surprised. I didn't know I did it all this time, and it really hurts, the person said, to do it. I need to find some way to not always be hurting this way. I didn't realize. I was always critical and judging, but because I was so concerned with what I was judging, I didn't see what the effect the judging had on me. But now that I've been still and quiet for these days, I see, wait a minute, I see this is a big impact on me. Or there's pervasive attitudes that people carry with them. Some people have the attitude, one person has the attitude that I'm not good enough. Whatever I do, I'm not good enough. And this was somehow conditioned into the person at a very young age from a parent. And then they didn't realize it. Everything is seen through this filter, not good enough. And that filter, that thought, that operating principle, is really hurts. To stop doing something that's hurtful stops the hurt. And so it's not easy at this deeper level of our psyche to do this. But you know, this is really the task of why mindfulness, concentration, being on retreats, a variety of things really help us get into the depths of our psyche, depths of our mind, so we can kind of begin doing this very ordinary thing at the depths of our mind. Yet clinging to self, clinging to pleasure, clinging to security. There's all these forms of clinging that we cling to, that if you really are sensitive and feel what's going on, you feel the harm that clinging causes us. But then letting go of that clinging can seem like a daunting task, it can seem like a frightening task, unreasonable task, but if you're really sensitive, you'll see that as long as you cling, there's some stress, some suffering in that clinging. And if you can have some time in your life where you take a vacation from clinging, hopefully you're willing to take a vacation once in a while. Even if you defend it, even if you think clinging is important, I gotta cling. But hopefully, you know, you can take a vacation sometimes. And retreats are meant to be a great vacation. So, but it's hard to do it. It can be very challenging. Sometimes there's a lot of inner wrestling. We wrestle with ourselves because all the lawyers in the mind come up and say, this is important to hold on or resist or be resentful or whatever. Or there's a lot of fear comes up. And so part of Dharma practice sometimes is a very dramatic and direct meeting with the challenges that we carry with us, what's going on. And because it can be so difficult, sometimes it's helpful to have something that supports us. Some kind of something that inspires us, keeps us going, that offers us support through it. And the Dharma is part of that support. In fact, the kind of classic definition of Dharma is Dharma is that which holds up, that which supports. It offers support. The etymology of the word Dharma comes from a Sanskrit word meaning support or to hold up. And so what is this Dharma that supports us if it's more than just a set of teachings and understanding? So I would like to, and why is it that it's comparable in people's lives to the idea of God? So I would like to give you an analogy of support. It's possible for human beings to float in the water, like in the ocean or a big lake. It's possible, right? But for the most part, people are not born knowing how to do that. And most people who don't know how to swim, if you throw them into the water, they'll drown. So, especially if it's fresh water, you know, it's not, you know, you're not buoyant enough in fresh water to float. And so, so the water is what makes, you know, helps us to float. You can float in the water holds us up. But you have to know something. You have to know how to float. You have to know how to swim. Otherwise, the water is deadly. But then you say, well, floating is the essential nature of a human being. It's a core of who I am. It's essential nature. The true nature of who I am is the ability to float. I'll rely on my true nature. And someone throws you into the water without that, before you know how to swim, and you'll drown anyway, believing in your true nature. We have a potential in our nature to float, but generally it has to be learned. And when we learn how to float, then it's the whole combination of the buoyancy of the water, our body, how we hold it, how we relax, how we tread water, how we make ourselves flat in the water, you know, our skill we learn. All those together conspire together to create the floating. It's not just you. It's not just the water. It's somehow the combination of it. You can't take a lot of personal responsibility for floating. It requires help and support of something. But you can't not take responsibility either. It also requires something from you. It's a mutuality and interaction. So we can't say we're supported by the water. That's not enough. And we can't say we're supported by ourselves, but, you know, that's not enough. We're supported by something in the interaction, some way in which we are in harmony with the forces of nature here in this situation. So that's what supports us when we float. That would be comparable with what Buddhism talks about as the Dharma. It's not a thing. It's not like something you can touch. And it's not something which is essential to who you are, like core, the essence, this is who I am, my true nature. It's not something that lives outside of you only. But it's something that is part of our potential that we can develop and that exists in this beautiful interaction with the world when we can figure out how to be in harmony with the world, with the laws of nature. And then we're supported by that. So to kind of come back to something perhaps to another angle to talk about this, I hope it follows. So in the world of suffering, one of the forms of suffering is chronic fear and anxiety. Another form of suffering is chronic anger, resentment, attacking, blaming. It arises out of a potential human beings have of, built into our system of fight or flight, which when the lion comes, was a useful skill, useful capacity, fight or flight. But the way in which we activate fight or flight to support our neurosis, you know, and we hold it so chronically and so continuously, our sense of self, our self-identity, you know, we're using it for things I don't think it was meant to be used for 40,000 years ago. This modern life of ours. And the cost of chronic tension of fear, anxiety, ambition, greed, chronic anger, aversion, is a kind of puts a filter, a veil, or a tension over our sensitivity, our capacity to be attentive and sensitive. And so that our empathy doesn't operate so smoothly. We're not relaxed. That which exists when we're relaxed doesn't quite be there. And some of you know that. If you're really angry or something, you don't think very clearly. Or some of you remember maybe when you were teenagers, when there was a lot of desire, sexual desire for someone, your thinking wasn't so clear either. Now I'm sure you're all clear. Certain kind of reactivity precludes the ability to be sensitive and aware and intelligent in some deep way. And so here I like to call it fight or flight kind of mentality or way of being. It has certain consequence in the world. There's an opposite that science is now coming up with. Fight and flight's been known for a long time. At least I've only read recently in modern research another term, which I think I taught here a few months ago. The opposite of fight or flight is called approach and soothe. both these, both fight and flight and approach and soothe, have physiological manifestations. So in fight or flight, the breathing gets speeded up, gets shallower off sometimes, the heart speeds up, we start to perspire, you know, get geared up, get tense. And then it's useful if you're fighting or flighting. With approach and soothe, the heart rate drops, breathing rate slows down, becomes deeper, and we release oxytocin into our system. And oxytocin is a wonderful hormone that makes people feel good, calms people down, brings kind of pleasure inside the body. Approach and so we have this physiological mechanism that's built into our human beings to feel good and to create a kind of certain kind of physiology in approach and soothe. This is very useful for a parent helping her child. You know, the child's hurt. It doesn't hurt the child to approach full of anxiety. You want to approach in a way that calms and makes the child feel safe. So you want to have a physiology that kind of is reassuring. And so we have built in this mechanism where we know what to do. So approach and soothe is not very easy to do if there's a lot of tension and fear and anxiety. But as we learn to relax and settle down, and some of the filters that we have over our hearts drops, then a different kind of sensitivity can happen, and then where empathy is possible. And that empathy gives rise to particular responses. Not even a matter of choice. It's not like you choose to do it, but it's kind of like this is what the heart will do. So the Dharma is something that supports us. The Dharma that is the way things are, or is the nature or the law, to be in harmony with that, is to realize that there are these different aspects of who we are, and which aspect is most harmonious, will create the best, most benefit for ourselves in the world. Which is wisest, which is freest? And which do you feed, which do you cultivate and develop? If you cultivate and develop the approach and soothe, or the relaxed, or the open, or the present, or the mindful, that allows for certain workings to happen through our hearts, through our minds, which are not exactly personal. The releasing of oxytocin is not actually a personal thing. It's just what happens. There's a whole area of functioning in our mind and body which is not necessarily a personal functioning. It's not like you choose to do it. Like if you can choose to cut yourself with a knife, but you can't exactly choose to heal. You create the best conditions for healing to happen. And it's a very complicated event, the healing of a cut. You can't, if you have to be an engineer, all the white blood cells and the immune system and everything kind of operating, you'd have a headache, a short circuit. But you create the right conditions to relax, to get the blood and the energy flowing nicely in your body, to keep the wound clean. And then something in your body knows what to do to create the healing. If we create the right conditions for our hearts, for our minds, our hearts and minds, to a great degree, will know what to do as well. So to take refuge in the Dharma is to understand these two sides. To understand that the Dharma practice in its essence is something very, very simple and ordinary. Something human beings do every day, thousands of times. But that the potential of doing it is often, the full potential of it is often not understood and appreciated. And if we want to get into the full potential of what this simple way of operating is, then it helps to have to take refuge or trust or be supported by a deeper nature here. To learn to float, to relax, not to tense up, not to grip, not to be in fight or flight with this reality of ours, but to learn to deeply, deeply be supported by something that's deeper. It's not a God that's external, but it's not the God which is our ego either. It's kind of impersonal, but it's not exactly outside of yourself. It's kind of impersonal, but it requires you to do something. You have to show up. But you can't take credit, exactly. And so, what is it that allows the heart to settle, to relax, to trust, so that the nature, we can be in harmony with nature and let nature move through us? And for in Buddhism, we call that the Dharma, to trust the Dharma, to take refuge in the Dharma, and more profoundly, most importantly, to be liberated by the Dharma, to be freed by that Dharma, to let the heart become free, so that all harming has stopped. The heart has no harm in it. The heart is free. The heart's at peace. That's the work of the Dharma. So, I hope that this was provocative, the two statements, and perhaps it'll give you something to talk about during when you stay for tea. So, thank you all very much.